Good evening and welcome to the fifth presentation in this our ninth series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Coots and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the blue back there, Peggy Wright, and with help from our webmaster, taking pictures at the back, Haiwan Wan, and our instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Christopher McConnell and Daniel Peach designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Daniel Pollard from the library's technology office. The Kentucky bourbon industry has been making the news in a big way lately, and on February 7th, the Courier-Journal announced that Zagat, the big travel guide, had named Louisville, Kentucky, one of the best foodie getaways around the world. And one of the reasons cited was the high-quality ground spirits available throughout Louisville, with a shout-out to the Buffalo Trace Distillery. Several weeks later, the paper ran a feature story entitled Kentucky's Libation Vacations and reported that almost 500,000 people had visited Kentucky's Bourbon Trail last year and that there were 4.7 million barrels of bourbon aging in Kentucky. Thus, it's a special pleasure to welcome the PR and events coordinator of Kentucky's oldest, continuously operating, and most honored distillery. She's a native of Evansville, Indiana, where her family, she says, have lived forever. And growing up, she wanted to be a nurse, a teacher, a hairdresser, and finally a writer, in that order. She was most influenced by a college professor who called her out the first time she tried to skip class. After attending schools in Evansville, she enrolled at the University of Southern Indiana, where she studied public relations and advertising. She's worked at the corporate offices of Shoe Carnival and Keller Crescent Advertising, where she got her start doing PR for the liquor industry. And in 2007, she began working for the Buffalo Trace Distillery as Distillery Events Manager. Presently, her duties involve public relations and events for the entire Sazerac Company, which consists of 9 facilities. Her home base is at the Buffalo Trace Distillery in Frankfort, Kentucky. And when not working, she enjoys practicing yoga and reading. Please give a warm welcome to Amy Preske.
Have any of you ever been to Buffalo Trace Distillery in Frankfort? A couple people? Okay. Good. Has anyone ever tried any of our products? Buffalo Trace, Blanton?
I'll just go ahead and leave my hand up.
Elmer T. Lee, Eagle Rare. Good, good. Glad to hear. Well, a couple years ago, we started working with the Louis B. Nunn Center for Oral History at the University of Kentucky to document our history at the distillery. We have been distilling for over 200 years, and we have a lot of employees there who've been there 40 or 50 years, and we've got a lot of legends there, like Elmer T. Lee, who's 92 and still going strong, and comes in once a week to taste barrels. And so we kind of wanted to capture everyone's history and before it was too late. So we worked with the Louis B. Nunn Center and we did an oral history project. I'm gonna show that to you now. Reduced it down, and this was actually playing on KET over the summer. And then we'll talk some more after that.
This is the story of a Kentucky distillery, its people, and their quest for the perfect bourbon.
We kind of feel like the best bourbon is never been made.
I feel like that perfect bourbon that I made.
These are the voices of people who have been making whiskey here for over a half a century.
And the colonel looked up at his high shade. He said, "Son, we're not hiring any hands today."
Well, that kind of attitude, I think, worked out years, driving my dad's truck.
Voices of descendants of iconic bourbon figures like Colonel E.H. Taylor Jr., Colonel Albert Blanton, and Pappy Van Winkle.
grandfather always said, produce a really premium product and keep it in seemingly short supply. Now, we're not having to keep it in short supply. It is in short supply.
I used to come out to the distillery when I was a little girl and play.
So he believed that fine whiskey deserved fine brands. Overlooking the Kentucky River, with buildings dating back over 200 years, this generation of people at Buffalo Trace share a common passion in their quest for the perfect bourbon. Buffalo Trace Distillery sits right on the bend of the Kentucky River at Frankfort, where the earliest settlers distilled their whiskey over 200 years ago. That settlement was called Leestown.
This site, Scott, is an evolution.
Leestown is the oldest settlement north of the Kentucky River. We know that whiskey early on was shipped from Leestown.
This site was literally where the Buffalo crossed the Kentucky River, and the settlement known as the Leestown Settlement was settled here in 1773. And we started the distilling process with that settlement.
The site itself would be ideal. Why? Because there was rich land for the production of corn. The water source was here, and most of the source. From central Kentucky. The Kentucky River was at that time described as very different from what it is now. In fact, it was a line of what are called shoals and pools. So it was not really very suitable for navigation beyond a canoe or a flatboat or even a keelboat.
Leestown, with its natural crossing, was about as far upriver as a boat could travel, making this site a true crossroads for people as well as buffalo.
The river systems in Kentucky are very important to the commerce of bourbon. The Kentucky River leads into the Ohio River leads to the Mississippi, and the Mississippi leads to New Orleans. And from very early times, that was the natural trade route out of Kentucky.
The oldest building would be 1792, and that's the little house that sits just outside our back door here. It was built by Commodore Richard Taylor.
Many small distillery operations continue to make whiskey here in the years up through the Civil War. Now, with the war ended and the river made accessible to larger shipping vessels, the markets for whiskey downstream were growing.
Whiskey, as I understand it, was not really scientifically produced until after the Civil War, and one of the individuals who was very active in the formation of standards for the purity of whiskey was E.H. Taylor, Jr.
And clearly, Edmund Haynes Taylor, coming here in 1870, had a profound impact.
E.H. Taylor is the one that took basically a farm distillery, from what I understand it, and turned it into a modern distillery.
Remarkably, the small distillery that E.H. Taylor Jr. purchased was the very site where his great-great-grandfather, Commodore Richard Taylor, had built his stone cabin on the riverside nearly 100 years before.
Colonel Taylor was an entrepreneur of all entrepreneurs.
He established 7 different distilleries. It's remarkable. And this guy was he was an entrepreneur, but at the same time, he took great pride in the purity of this
product. In his goal to produce a greater quantity of whiskey, he was not willing to sacrifice the quality of whiskey and became a defender. Now, partially the reason for that would be that a better product, a superior product, was more profitable.
Up through the last part of the 19th century, you had straight whiskey distillers like E.H. Taylor, and you had what you call rectifiers. A lot of the rectifiers were very respectable people that were doing things simply like taking barrels from this distillery and barrels from this other distillery, you know, distillery A and distillery B, and marrying them together to come up with a flavor profile they liked. Others were making things that we would call blended whiskey today. They were taking straight whiskey and adding it to neutral spirits to lighten it up. Then you even had the real disreputable ones that were taking things and making whiskey out of everything. I've actually seen a recipe that called for add a little sulfuric acid to it to give it burn, and use the char spittings from tobacco, chawing tobacco, to give it color. So they got a law passed that said that the whiskey that was in this bottle all came from the same distillery, was all made in the same season, at least 4 years old, and bottled at 100 proof, all under government supervision.
Utilized the most modern methods and created what at that time must have been a model operation for the production of bourbon whiskey.
Albert's entire span here was pop marked with one crater after another, from World War One to Prohibition to Great Depression to World War Two. Quite a set of challenges. And the fact that he did all of that, the story prospered, really prospered. And he was able, while he was doing all that, to build these type of buildings. Quite remarkable.
Blanton actually joins the company in the late 1800s, works his way up till he becomes the plant manager of the distillery before Prohibition.
When I told him about Albert Blanton's lifestyle, he had parties quite often, and when he did, he'd ask the warehouse to bring him some samples out of his favorite warehouse, and he'd tell him what age he wanted, and it was 8 years or better, and bring him those samples, and he'd sample them, taste test them, and he'd pick out one or two barrels and he'd say, bottle those for me. And he'd use those for his entertainment purpose.
The fact that somebody in 1935 thought to build this cabin, when they could have put up a rock building, but someone took the time to build gardens. And that's a lot of the motivation. I'm dying, carried out here in my box. I want to make sure that we hand this place on to the next generation. And that in another 100 years, somebody will say, thank goodness they did those things for the story. In the same way that we appreciate what Albert Blanton did back in 1920, 1930, 1935. I think it's important we do the same thing, that it be preserved, promoted, enhanced. Because it is a remarkable collection of buildings and architecture and history.
Pappy Van Winkle was a man much like E.H. Taylor. He knew how to market.
My father and grandfather were doing this back in the 50s and 60s, so it's nice to see what's going on there. They had it right back then. shell-aged premium bourbon whiskey.
Pappy Van Winkle, he was a very innovative person.
My grandfather always said, produce a really premium product and keep it in seemingly short supply. Now, we're not having to keep it in short supply. It is in short supply. Our relationship with Buffalo Trace as of 2002, it's a joint venture. It's a nice feather in their cap to have our brand. It's a feather in my cap to be associated with this distillery just because of the quality of the people and the quality of the brands here.
Generally, on a, say a marriage in Buffalo Trace, there's eight or nine of us that'll go taste, and it has to pass everybody. Everybody has to pass it. If just one person says it doesn't, something's not right, they have to retaste and redo the whole batch if they don't, and they won't let it go. So it has to go through a pretty rigorous test before it gets put out and be released for Buffalo Trace or for anything.
Through the generations, even as the name of the distillery changed from Old Fashioned Copper and Carlisle to the George T. Stagg Company, Shenley, and H&H, the quality of the product has always been in the hands of the people who work here.
I think in the people sense, Elma T. Lee has been a wonderful person to work alongside. He's like the grandfather I never had, which is how I look upon
him. Elmer has been an awfully big help to me out here over the years.
Arlo Shelton brought me in to interview for a job here when I graduated. And he took me in to see Colonel Blanton. He had these armbands, like you see gamblers wearing, on each arm, and a green eye shade on, and he looked up at me. And Arlo said, "Colonel, this is a young man I've been telling you about. I want him to come to work down here. I wanted you to meet him." And the colonel looked up out of his eye shade. He said, "Son, we're not hiring any hands today." And I thought that was the end of the interview. We got outside. Arlo said, "Don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. You come to work Monday morning." And I did. And every time I passed the colonel in on the lot, he looked at me kind of, I could see what he was thinking, "How in the hell did you get in here?"
Elma T. Lee gets a lot of credit for Blanton's single barrel.
You know, when bourbon was on a deep decline, they created the concept of the modern single barrel bourbon.
One of the owners of the plant came to me, and I was the manager. She said, "Elmer, we want to come out with a premium bourbon. Give us your thoughts and ideas as to how we can develop premium price bourbon." The concept of selecting the best aged whiskey and bottling it one barrel at a time started with the first brand we put out was Blanton's, and it didn't take off very well. The first year or two was just, but as the word got out and people started trying it, it took a turn up, still going up.
Retiring on at least three occasions because what they bring to the distillery is so vitally important, not only in terms of their everyday performance, but their institutional knowledge and their wonderful understanding of the warehouse system.
Luckily for me, I have two guys that have been in the distillery business together for 94 years.
We know where this whiskey comes from. And so, you know, just like an E.T. Lee, you know, it's going to be a little spicy. And we know that. And so we know where this stuff is going to be aged at in the labs. And the Eagle Rares, you know, it's got a little different quality taste to it. And so it's that same way with the regular wheat whiskey, the regular straight rye whiskey. It's got places in the winehouses, certain winehouses, that will age better than other spots. Most time jobs cover the one and two. You do this job, you double check it. Okay, Glen Rue and I, we do like a four stage, you know. So we check the whiskey four different times, make sure we got the right whiskey we're using. The right whiskey has been aged at the right time. So we got like a four step deal, you know, for most of us, a two step. Because we have no room for mistakes.
It would be nice to have this period be thought of as the period of renovation and restoration, with particular attention to the team of people that made it possible. So whether you're looking at running Lennon, or whether you're looking at Alan Wheatley, or you're looking at the continued involvement of Alan Teeley, and quite frankly, the involvement of the Johnson family, and the involvement of all the other people that come to the Trace to help make it work. So we have this project called Holy Grail, which ironically may end up being very similar to the Holy Grail that we may search forever.
It's still too that perfect bourbon. And like I said, it happened far away from her, but if it don't, then I feel like it still will happen.
But I think it's a very worthwhile adventure. And of course, who's to say what the perfect or the best bourbon ever made is? We're imagining that's in the eye of the beholder.
You know, if I was to pass away tomorrow, this has been a wonderful life for me here in Buffalo Trace. All the time I've spent here at this distillery, you couldn't have asked anything any better, you know. To me, like I said something before, every day I come to work here is when I come to a candy factory, you know, full of chocolates. And so if you're waiting to get one more bite of that chocolate, you know, like you would keep the candy store. I'm still looking at that perfect bourbon yet for Mike.
We'll come back and have a drink of it.
We'll come back, yeah, here we go. We'll come back and have a big drink of it.
That's really what we're all about. I'll tell you a little bit more about us. So if you were to come to Buffalo Trace, which I hope you all will someday, those of you who have not been here yet, this is what you would see when you come in our entrance. The site was actually settled in 1773, back when Kentucky was still part of the state of Virginia. Virginia settlers moved west. It always seems strange to me that the site, there were people there distilling before we were even a country. But I guess priorities for alcohol overruled. our first modern distillery was built in 1857, and then we distilled whiskey continuously through Prohibition. We actually had a license for medicinal purposes, and we were allowed, people were allowed 3 pints a month for alcohol. And there were a lot of sick people during Prohibition. And we always thought that that it was, the doctor would say, you know, like a pint of bourbon or whatever. We didn't realize until we came across some old prescriptions that people had donated to us that he would actually specify what you needed. it would say like a pint of Cream of Kentucky, that was one of our bourbons at the time, or a pint of Golden Wedding or something. So that was interesting to us. We just assumed. But that's how a lot of the, in some states, I can't remember how it is in this part of the state, but I know in Indiana where I'm from, the CVS's and the Walgreens and everything all sell alcohol, and that's why, because that's how all that got started. We also produced, you know, during the flood of 36, and I say that because you probably noticed from the show that we were right on the Kentucky River, so we do flood a lot. We actually had a flood a few years ago. Around Derby time, you guys had a lot of flooding over here too. We did as well. And then during World War I and during World War II, the things that never get touched during wars are hospitals and distilleries. And the reason for that is the government will take over your distillery and make you produce for the war effort. So we were allowed to produce, I think it was 2 weeks out of the month we had to produce for the war effort, and then the remaining two weeks we could produce for us. So that's kind of a little interesting part of history. And then we were renamed the Buffalo Trace Distillery in 1999 when the Sazerac Company bought us. The Sazerac Company is a family-owned company. They're based in New Orleans. And a lot of what Buffalo Trace is known for is our architecture, our history, our craft, and then our natural beauty. Our architecture, you probably noticed the buildings, we're actually the only distillery with buildings from the 1700s, 1800s, and 1900s. So we have a complete evolution of the American industrial development. We have some warehouses that are all brick, we have all brick and limestone, and we have metal. We're the only distillery I've seen that have those three different, most have all metal or all brick or whatever. So I asked Harlan Wheatley, our master distiller one time, well, how come, you know, we've got these different, you know, building structures, and I thought it was going to be something elaborate, like, oh, well, we realized that it aged best in this type or this. He said, it's whatever we had money for at the time. And we have a lot of history, as you probably gathered. As I mentioned, we're the only distillery to continuously distill from 1787 to the present day, including through two World Wars and Prohibition. We are currently listed on the National Historic Registry, and we're working towards becoming a National Historic Landmark. We've got that application in, so hopefully it'll go through soon. And over 50% of the work at the distillery is still done by hand. And we don't make our barrels by hand anymore there at the distillery. We used to a long time ago, but we farm that out, as all the distilleries do, to a company in Lebanon, Kentucky called Independent Stave. But all of our bottling, not all of our bottling, a lot of our bottling is done by hand. You saw them applying the labels and stuff, and we have several hand bottling halls, so a lot of our work is still done by hand. And then the other thing we're known for is our natural beauty. Hopefully you got that from some of the photos, but we have 140 acres at the distillery, and so we have thousands of trees, flowers, birds, fish, deer, and wildlife, and we have wetlands, we have the riverfront. We have a hardwood forest, we have a limestone bluffs. It's always interesting working there because you never know what you're going to see, including sometimes in your office, snakes and squirrels and raccoons that fell out of the ceiling tile one day during a meeting, so interesting. And we're actually also building a botanical garden, and we just started on that. We're going to finish that off this summer. And we plan to get that certified by the AZA, and if so, that's, I think, basically only the third certified botanical garden in the state of Kentucky. So that would be very nice. Buffalo Trace has a lot of firsts. We were the first American distillery to win Distillery of the Year by Malt Advocate magazine, which is an industry magazine. We're the first American distillery to own Distiller of the Year award by Whiskey magazine. Now, Whiskey magazine is a European magazine, and there were a lot of Scottish distillers that were really unhappy when we won Distiller of the Year in 2005. We were the first to commercially market single barrel bourbon. You probably heard Elmer T. Lee talk about that. That was in 1984, where he created that, started from the concept of Colonel Blanton saying, I'm going to have a party, bring me the best bourbon in the warehouse, and then, oh, we should bottle it up and sell it. So, we were smart that we trademarked the Blanton's name. Unfortunately, we did not have the foresight to copyright the single barrel bourbon. So that's why there's a lot of single barrel bourbons out there. So we were the first to incorporate the use of steam power and the first to use temperature controlled warehouses. Now, that means that when the temperature outside drops below 45 degrees, we learned that the bourbon doesn't age anymore. It just lays dormant in your barrels. So we use steam power to control that, so we have actually all seasons of aging. A lot of the only other, I think Turkey may do this, but I'm not sure. I know that none of the other distilleries do that. So we actually get, you know, a full, however, if it's 4 year, 8 year, whatever, we get that full seasoning time, winter, rather than it just laying there not interacting with the wood. And then we were also the first distillery to ship whiskey down the Mississippi River. And guess where it went? New Orleans. Ever heard of Bourbon Street? That's right, it's called Bourbon Street. Over the last decade, we've won more than 200 national and international awards for our bourbons. And the distillery itself has been honored. We've been named the best distillery 7 times in the last 10 years. My favorite is the 2010 Whiskey Visitor Attraction of the Year by Whiskey Magazine. I say that because obviously I work in the tourism and visitor area, so Whiskey Magazine named us the best visitor attraction to go to, so that's my favorite award. But so by the numbers, to give you kind of an overview of Buffalo Trace, as I mentioned, we have 140 acres, and on those 140 acres, we have 130 buildings. We have 12 90,000 gallon fermenting tanks, and we have 4 different stills that actually can produce bourbon. That's the largest in the industry, and we are not running at full capacity. We did at one time, but we're not now, but we could, and right now we're probably running at about 50% capacity, and we're cranking it out. So I can't even imagine what it would be like to be at full capacity. We can cook 10,000 bushels of corn every day. We have 6 corn silos, which stand 53 feet tall. We have 3 cookers, which can hold about 17,000 gallons. And we have 12 warehouses, which are storing 335,000 barrels. And they are packed full. There is not any empty space at all. In fact, our CEO just told me today that we have a bid to buy 2 buildings back from the state that are currently in bankruptcy that we used to own, but sold before Sazerac bought us, but we want those buildings back. They are actually on our footprint, so we can use them again for warehouses, because we're just out of barrel space. And we have about 350 employees that work at our Frankfort location. So some of you may be wondering, what is bourbon whiskey? Well, according to the US government in 1964, at least 51% of bourbon must be corn. It cannot be distilled higher than 160 proof. It cannot be entered into the barrel higher than 125 proof or entered into the bottle at less than 80 proof. And it must be aged in a new charred oak barrel. Note that does not say American oak barrel, because we've got some experiments going on with French oak, Mongolian oak, but the typical one is a American oak barrel. No artificial additives are allowed. This means no caramel coloring, which is why Jack Daniel's is not a bourbon, because their charcoal filtering is adding coloring to it. And why would you want to add coloring? So you don't have to age it very long, and it looks like it's aged longer. And it must be made in the United States. Now notice I didn't say Kentucky. And a lot of people think that bourbon has to be made in Kentucky, and that's not true. In fact, bourbon's being made in Texas, there's a distillery. There's one in Wyoming that's getting ready to release something. There's one in Colorado. We actually own a distillery in Virginia that's a micro distillery. So even though 95% of the bourbon is produced here in this state, it by law does not have to be produced in the state of Kentucky. So for Buffalo Trace, our bourbon strategy is we want to produce the top quality whiskey, plain and simple, no expenses spared. I think whenever Ronnie and Leonard, I know they're sometimes kind of hard to understand with their accents, but they were talking about the quality checks, that we have 4 quality checks, and most distilleries have 2, and we have 4 stages that the barrel passes after it's filled. We also have that tasting table that Marsha was talking about, where if one of us, I say us because I am a member of the tasting panel, although I haven't been going down there tasting a lot, and yes, we do spit, disagrees and thinks the product isn't good, then it does not get used. Our second strategy is we have an excellent variety of tastes, because we have realized that in order to get new consumers to our category and maintain the interest of existing consumers, you have to give them a variety of taste. And how do you do that? You have a right, we have a variety of recipes. We actually have 5 different recipes we use in the distillery, and there is no other distillery that's doing that. So we have a wheat recipe. There's actually only 5 wheated bourbons on the market. We have 2 of them, which would be our Weller and our Pappy Van Winkle. And then there's Maker's Mark is a wheated bourbon. And there is Rebel Yell and El Fitzgerald. And we also use our age recipe. You can get a wide range of tastes for that. And our whiskeys are aged. We have a broad portfolio. We have 4 years old all the way up to 23 years old. And I will tell you that when we dumped a barrel of 20, Pappy 20 this week, and it had 7 gallons in it, we were excited by that. So we pay taxes on that, though, for the entire 20 years. So it's that bottle sells for about $100, and you're lucky if you can find it, first of all. And people say, oh my God, that's outrageous. Yeah, it is outrageous, but you have to remember, we've been paying taxes on that for 20 years. Well, it's just sitting there evaporating. Called the Angel's Share, actually, when it evaporates. These are some of our brands. I mentioned our Van Winkle collection. I was just talking about that. This is our antique collection. It comes out once a year. It usually sells out promptly. Although I did see that this Sazerac 18, which has won a slew of awards, is at one of your liquor stores here. I was surprised by that, because it comes out in the fall and it's gone like immediately. And then we have our Buffalo Trace, our Ancient Age, which is an old brand for us that a lot of people know us by. Our Blanton's, those the first single barrel. Our Weller, our 1792 bourbon, which we make over in Bardstown. And our Sazerac Rye, Elmer T. Lee, and Eagle Rare. And we actually have over 200 bourbons. Or 200 brands, I'm sorry, not 200 bourbons, 200 brands. That includes our vodka and liqueurs and cordials. That's just a handful of the different bourbons that we have. We have Benchmark. I know I saw a big display on Benchmark here today, so I know that's here in your area. We also are known worldwide for our experimental collection. And we actually started our experimental collection more than 20 years ago. And since then, we have 150 experimental barrels of whiskey aging in our warehouses. And each of them is different. Some of these may have unique mash bills, different types of wood. I mentioned like Mongolian oak or French oak, different barrel toast, and which means it could be, you know, toasted a light toast versus a darker toast, you know, how long it's fired after it's put together. And so a few times a year we bottle these up. They're very, very limited because a lot of them are in small quantities. This barrel that's pictured here is the regular 53-gallon, but a lot of them are just 15-gallon or 20-gallon or something like that. And we put them in the 375 bottles because, number one, they are a very small batch, and number two, we just felt like it goes a little further for consumers when they want to buy them at the store, that if they're in smaller bottles. So we've won a lot of awards for our different experiments. We've had like a double-aged bourbon. We've had a Chardonnay aged and a French oak. The latest one we had come out was some barrels we had with rice as the main grain and then with oats as the main grain. So that was kind of interesting. So we've got all kinds of experiments going on. It's a fun place to be. And the nice thing about it is we're set up that since we are family owned, we don't have a board of directors that says, that's crazy, why are you wasting your time and your money on that? You know, we can do that stuff. Our CEO, Mark, that you saw earlier, is very supportive of that. And it's nice that we can all have ideas and input. If I say to Harlan, have we ever done an experiment on whatever? He'll say, nope, but I'll add it to the list. So everyone can have an input on different experiments. And one of our biggest experiments we've done, that anyone has done, is called our Single Oak Project. This project was actually started in 1999, and it's pretty intensive, so I've tried to kind of summarize it. We do have a cool website on it, though, if you want to look more at it. But we picked 96 trees. We sent Ronnie Eddins, that you saw earlier, we sent him into the forest in the Ozark Mountains, and he picked 96 trees, and he divided them, and then we aged them and put GPS locators on them because we're weird and anal like that. And then once the trees were ready, we divided them into the top and bottom halves, which yielded 192. And then we had a single barrel made from each of those sections. And then we did 7 different variables on those barrels. We experimented with the char level between what we call number 3 and number 4 char. We experimented with the recipe. Some were rye, some were wheat. We experimented with the warehouse. Some were concrete floor, some were wooden floor. The entry proof, that we did 105 proof and a 125 proof. The grain size, which means on the actual tree itself, was it a tight grain or an average grain? And the stave seasoning, which are the barrel staves, how long it was left outside. And then the tree sections, the top of the tree and the bottom of the tree. So in all, that's almost 1,400 combinations were created. And we are releasing these 4 times a year for 4 years. We just had the 4th release, should be hitting shelves any day now, it's not already out. And this is part of our Holy Grail project that Mark, our CEO, talked about, and our whole quest for the perfect bourbon, because consumers can really get involved with this. When they go onto the singleoakproject.com website, they can register their bottle, and then, because each of them are numbered, and then rate the tasting of it. And then we're going to take all of those scores after 4 years and see which one was the number 1, and then make that, that'll be a new product for us. So consumers are pretty much deciding what they think is the perfect bourbon. So we'll see. We released it, we announced it last April. We brought some whiskey writers in from all around the world to taste it, and they were just blown away that we would even be this, you know, painstaking and anal about tracking all this, and trying to grasp our head around all the variables. And we had a couple guys in from the UK that our whiskey writers are travel all around. There's 5,000 distilleries in the world, and they both said this: no other distillery is doing anything even close to this. You guys are crazy. So finally, now that I've come to see you guys, I hope you come see us. A little plug for tourism portion. We are located in Frankfurt. We have tours Monday through Friday from 9 to 3 and Saturday from 10 to 2. We're actually getting ready to start tours on Sundays as well. We just got a tasting still passed in Frankfurt, which will allow us to sample after our tour. We sample after all of our tours. And we have 4 types of tours. We have our trace tour, which is the run-of-the-mill, walk in off the street, take it every hour on the hour. We have our hard hat tour, which goes behind the scenes and looks at those big cookers and fermenters that I was bragging about. We have our post-prohibition tour, which talks about all the architecture that I was talking about in the different buildings. And we really had kind of a resurgence with building after Prohibition ended, and built a ton of buildings after then. So this kind of talks about what was built then and the architecture behind it. And then we have a ghost tour. We were actually just featured recently on the TV show Ghost Hunters that aired on Sci-Fi. And we're actually evidently a fairly active site. So we have ghost tours now, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evenings. So reservations are required for 3 of those 4 tours, but they all are free. We just do that so we have an idea of how many people are coming. And as I mentioned, all of our tours do end with a tasting and a bourbon ball, which I brought tonight so you can see. That's it. Questions for me?
Questions?
Yeah.
Along with your tourism, you're also an event manager.
Right.
And we have some students who are interested in event managing.
Uh-huh.
So could you tell us how events play into the whole tourism thing?
Sure.
And the
yeah.
Buffalo Trace Distillery?
Yeah. Well, we're lucky because we have a clubhouse on our site which seats 300 people. That was part of what Colonel Lanton built that we were talking about in the film. And I think we've paired up pretty much everybody in Frankfurt, and we're working on Lexington and Louisville now. And so we also do a lot of corporate events when we bring groups in. And we have gotten a lot smarter and better about making sure we offer them tours beforehand. I mean, we kind of haphazard did it, but now we're really getting it all down. We have a little cafe that we open up during the summer, and we are, you know, people that are having meetings during the summer, you know, here's a menu if you would like to order from our cafe. It's So we're trying to get kind of a more full package going. And then we also have consumer events that we do 4 times a year that are free to the public that I supervise as well. We have Easter egg hunts, a 4th of July 5K race, a Halloween event, and a Christmas event. And we usually have well over 1,000 people that attend all of those. And of course, those are all counted as visitors. Because even if you set foot on the property, you're a visitor. So in addition to our tour visitors, we count our clubhouse visitors, our special event visitors. So last year we had about 65,000 come and visit at the distillery. And the ghost tours have been going really well. And I mean, that's a perfect example of taking something that, you know, the ghost hunters people called me and said, hey, we've had all these viewers tell us that your distillery is haunted and we want to come and investigate. And I'm like, tell me about it. I work late. I know there's some strange stuff going on. So they came. It was a very painstaking process for there to interview everyone and make sure you're not just making everything up. And I probably worked with them for about 6 months before they actually came. And then they filmed for about 2 weeks there. And it was airing in November. We were bummed because we wanted it to air in October around Halloween, but that didn't work out for us. We didn't have to say it, obviously. So that's a good example of taking that and really capitalizing it because, you know, after that, you know, we said, well, we got to get ghost tours together, a ghost tour together, and, you know, launch that the day after this airs. And then we had a local TV person come out and interviewed me the day that the show was airing so we could, you know, tell people to go and watch it. We did some POS stuff in our gift shop. We did our ghost tour special t-shirts, shot glasses, and flashlights. And the ghost tours, since they've been running, they just run Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights. They started in November, and they've been booked solid every single slot for every night. So they've been going over really well. So, of course, that's nice to add to our tourism numbers, too. So it's just different ways you can be creative and think of ways that you can get people in your door that maybe wouldn't not have thought of coming before. We've had people come to our ghost tours like dressed in like Ghostbusters costumes and all kinds of crazy things, but it's a visitor. So.
How about weddings?
Tons of weddings. In our clubhouse, we are booked up the rest of this year and most of next year, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evenings. I'm sorry, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday evenings, some Thursdays, some Mondays, just all kinds of crazy days for people wanting to get married there because we have our grounds are so beautiful. They can get married inside or outside. Our rates are reasonable. We are not full service. They're free to use their own caterer, which they like because it can save them money. It's just another example of a creative way you can get visitors in the door, get people exposed to your distillery. Again, they sometimes wedding parties will do tours as well. So we've actually had a couple of wedding parties buy their own barrel of bourbon and then give it to their guest or to at least to the people in the wedding with their personalized label on it. So that's a little pricey, but we have had a couple of people do that. So all about marketing.
Questions? How does cooking with bread, that seems to be a hot thing now, cookbooks with bourbon, how does that play into the bourbon business?
It does. In fact, actually, we make a bourbon cream, which is a really good cream liqueur that I saw down at Chuck's. You guys have it down at Chuck's. And it's only sold here in the state of Kentucky. It's kind of like Bailey's, but it's made with Buffalo Trace instead of Irish whiskey, obviously. And I have a really good contact at the Food Network. And he called me and he wants to use it for Chopped, the Chopped episode. I guess it's where they take things and they give various ingredients and say, make something out of this. And so the bourbon cream is going to be on a future episode of Chopped. So, but we've done a lot of cooking pairings and dinners and all across the country. And a lot of times as part of my events, portion, I'll set those up. We've done some in New Orleans, obviously, they have a big affinity for bourbon. We have a good relationship with the Bourbon House down there, so we do some events with them, or chefs here in Kentucky, and sometimes we'll bring in like the Van Winkles or our master Sarah Harlan, and they'll talk about how the dinner pairs with the bourbon and how the dishes are prepared with bourbon. Anything else?
I got another question. Other questions? Yeah, go ahead. you were talking about the difference between a regular whiskey and a bourbon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jack Daniels, a lot of people think Jack Daniels is bourbon.
Right.
And we in Kentucky all know it's
exactly,
not.
Yes.
Besides the caramel coloring, what differentiates a bourbon legally from what they do in
the That is the major thing. And a lot of people say that all bourbon is whiskey, but not all whiskey is bourbon. So the main thing that separates Jack Daniels is their caramel, I think they call it charcoal maple filtering or something like that, which basically is adding, they're running it through this charcoal filter process, and it adds at least behind the resin and at least behind the color. So how you get the color from your bourbon is through the wood of the barrel. So that when I mentioned earlier that we heat our warehouses when it goes beneath 45 degrees, so that it constantly can go in and out of the barrel, in and out of the barrel, pick up color and flavor. And when you have a young bourbon, it'd be a lot of times light in color because it's not been in there very long. If you have an old bourbon, it's usually more richer and more of an amber hue to it. So the main difference between the bourbon and the whiskey is it's either they probably added some kind of coloring agent to it, it may be less than 2 years old is the other thing, because bourbon has to be at least 2 years old. So those are the two main things that separate it. Anything else?
You brought some chocolates along. Thanks. How did you get into the chocolate business and what's the involvement?
Well, we work with Rebecca Ruth Candies, which is based in Frankfurt, and they make our bourbon balls for us. They are given after our tours. And they're also given, you know, we have a lot of kids that actually come on our tours. And we actually have a playground there at the distillery as well, which seemed really odd to me when I first took my interview and I saw a playground outside of our CEO's office. But I'm kind of used to it now. There's a lot of families that come there and have picnics and bring their kids and stuff. A lot of the kids will drink our root beer. We have a root beer we serve, which is not non-alcoholic. So a lot of the kids will drink the root beer and eat the bourbon balls after the tour. So we partnered with Rebecca Ruth, and we went through several versions of a recipe to come up with a recipe that we liked using our bourbon. And I think we actually, it's actually number 80-something, the final product is. They make it especially for us using our bourbon, and then they make their own bourbon ball, too, that they sell at their stores in Frankfurt and then in liquor stores, too. They do not use our bourbon. They do not use our recipe. However, they always enter both versions in the Kentucky State Fair every year, and every year ours has beat theirs, so.
And you'll get a chance to sample some
tonight.
Yes,
right. Please do.
One final question, some students, anything you're curious about?
How do we become a taster?
You do have to be certified for that. It's a long testing.
Long testing,
process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like a wine tasting, similar?
You have to go to the lab and taste every day and get your mouth used to it, because, you know, you're tasting like 40 different products at once, and, you know, your mouth really starts to burn after a while. Even though you're spitting it out, it's you know, strong. So, and then you gradually work up and they'll start testing you. And they'll give you, and they're all blind tests. And the hardest one for me was vodka, because by definition, vodka is odorless, tasteless, colorless. So how am I supposed to tell what these four different vodkas are? So that was harder for me than the bourbons was. Because they like to throw little curveballs to you, too, on the tasting panel. Like, they'll sometimes put another product in that it'll be all Buffalo Trace, but one will be Eagle Rare or something, and see if anybody notices. So they're tricky.
Do you have a favorite of all the bourbons? Can you say that?
Yeah, my favorite is Elmer T. Lee. It's a sweeter bourbon. It's a single barrel. It's aged about 9 or 10 years. And I think I'm a little biased because I have such an affinity for Elmer. That was the older gentleman that was on camera. Because I'm actually Elmer's caretaker. So when Elmer travels, I travel with them. And if someone wants to do an interview with Elmer, they have to go through me. So he's kind of like... Mark says he's like the grandfather we never had. He says he's like a father figure to me. My father's a little older as well, so Elmer and I just kind of latched on to each other. So I think that's probably biasing my personal favorite bourbon, but it's a good one.
Well, Well, it's, on behalf of WKU Libraries Friends Organization, our genial host here at Barnes & Noble, we want to especially thank Amy for spending an evening with us, enlightening us about the wonders of Buffalo Trace bourbon. Mm-hmm. And if you'd like to come sample some of the bourbon ball chocolate, we certainly welcome. So, and otherwise, have a good evening.
Yeah.